Right now, time to welcome in David Tarachuk. It is time for the Media Beat on Robin Hood Radio. You can find David on his website, which is themediabeat.us. David is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and we welcome him in this Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Hello there. I'm glad to be reporting in again from the media capital of the world, New York City, and of course to be joining the always incisive Marshall Miles. Well, the midterms are really upon us, Marshall, right? Only two Tuesdays from now, the entire nation will be voting. Coast to coast, as they used to say on network TV.
Yeah, and you know, the ebb and flow of what people think is going to happen, what polls say are going to happen, continue. I was just talking about this the other day. I think we can take polls and put them in the uncertain category because they've been wildly it's wildly off.
There's no better way of putting it than just saying they were off.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. So, they've not got a good reputation in recent election cycles. Absolutely not. And they're a big feature. I mean, they're with us at all times, of course. But as we get close to election day, they assume even greater importance in newsrooms' minds, and inevitably they place a lot of reliance upon them, perhaps too much. There have been so many examples where our reliance has been misplaced. But a lot of the traditional media rituals come up afresh at this point in the calendar. I've been looking in particular this week at live TV debates, that are most ritualistic of all the accompaniments to the nation's voting. The debates, some of them are coming a bit too late to make any real difference to how people vote. One of the reasons that the polls are as iffy sometimes as you were suggesting is, of course, that people don't tell the whole truth when they're canvassed by a pollster. And by this stage in the game, many people have made their minds up, even though they describe themselves to pollsters as being undecided. So where are we in the cycle? Are we at a point where these TV debates will make a difference? It's hard to tell. One particular United States Senate race in Pennsylvania might still influence people, though a lot of eyes trained upon it. The only debate there between the TV doctor Mehmet Oz for the Republicans, who's a Trump-endorsed candidate, of course, and Democrats John Fetterman, the existing lieutenant governor of the state. Many viewers, let's put it this way, and indeed the candidate himself, John Fetterman, made it very clear right from the beginning. He said, "I've suffered a stroke," and that's, you know, on the record, and it's very clear, very evident in his public appearances. His recovery from that stroke has so far reached a point where many viewers probably felt he was not fully able to put on a strong public performance, and that's unfortunate. Many in the media reviewing the debate automatically put this down as a low score politically. They were assuming, of course, that audiences would see this as a sign that he wouldn't function well in representing the state in Washington. Other commentators, not so many of them, I'd have to say, felt that it might actually get him some sympathy vote. That's maybe a little politically cynical, perhaps not even true. But it's inevitably, unfortunately, a media effect we're talking about here, the assessment of his cognitive ability. There's no getting away from the fact that the camera and the microphone really emphasize his kind of performance difficulty, fairly or unfairly. I noticed some critics said it was painful to watch Fetterman struggle with his communication. It was also, we should also point out, I think, pretty painful to watch Mehmet Oz struggling to defend himself against charges of profiting in the past from the promotion and sale of unproven medical treatments in his, through his daytime TV show. And he also struggled with the Trump connection, which he happily embraced to get the nomination. But now, in the general election, he's trying to avoid it. He's now saying he wants to, and this is a quote to cherish, he wants to, quote, make Washington civil again. There's not been a lot of civility so far in this particular race.
You know, I watched snippets of the debate, and yes, Fetterman had his problems because, you know, he is recovering from a stroke. But I looked at it this way. I didn't think it was pitiful. I think it was something he had to do, whether advisors wanted him to do it or not. I think he had to do it. I think he made a very strong and decision that, well, you know what, I'll take my chances, but I'm going to present myself as to somebody recovering from a stroke and do the best I can. And in comparison with Oz, who has been struggling minus a stroke all along, I don't feel this is going to have a huge impact on the campaign. And I give him a lot of credit for getting up there and doing the debate when he could have just stayed on the sideline. So we'll have to see what happens there. But, you know, you've got there, you've got Georgia, which is a very big state that is coming up. And if the Democrats want to get a hold of the Senate, they're going to have to win Pennsylvania and Georgia to at least hold the Senate, if not get enough votes to actually not have a 50-50 split.
That's right. And already clear in Georgia, one of the interesting things about that race between Reverend Raphael Warnock and ex-footballer Herschel Walker, excuse me, apart from the scandal about the anti-abortionist Herschel Walker being revealed as someone who would finance abortion, and indeed he's accused of doing it twice over, actually funding an abortion for a girlfriend, a pregnant girlfriend. Apart from that, one striking feature of the race there is the enormous size of the early mail-in ballot. Huge, a million already sent in just in the past few days. It is, analysts can see, and it's probably, it is true. I mean, there's no getting away from this. It's very obvious when you look at the districts involved. It's suggestive of a Democratic surge in these early mail-in ballots, while Republicans, on the other hand, their voters are obviously favoring the idea of voting on the day. Which is a complete reversal of how things used to be, if you'll recall, Marshall. Mail-in ballots were favored by Republicans when they were still new. It's so interesting and a reflection of the power of information and misinformation and indeed deliberate disinformation that you've now got a complete swing in opinion about the reliability of mail-in ballots. There's no evidence at all that mail-in ballots are in any way insecure, any more insecure than in-person votes, but that's the myth that so many Republican activists are working up now, and it may rebound against them. Again, rather like the Pennsylvania situation, we'll only know for sure in 11 days' time from now.
And you know, that I think that also this early voting has also put out another problem for pollsters, because when you poll this late in the election, voters have cast their votes. They're done.
Yeah, absolutely. Another variable to try and factor in, which just makes the whole science, if that's what it is, polling, that much more complicated, that much more difficult.
All right.
And can I talk about the media news of the week?
Well, absolutely.
There's no doubt that most of the week's news has been news about the media themselves, especially digital media. Elon Musk, finally today, or last night at least, finally officially becoming Twitter's new owner, Twitter, and immediately firing top executives at Twitter, the C-suite, as it's known, the CEO, the CFO, the chief, well, she's been known as the chief censor, which is an unfair title, but the executive in charge of public policy has gone as well in the first few hours of that flipping and flopping struggle by Musk to get a hold of that company. Yes, immediately these top executives were fired. He reminded us, I guess, that he was constantly accusing them of misleading him while in pursuit of the final agreement over the last weeks and months. And I have to say, at the same time, he's cleared up none of the uncertainty about just how he's going to achieve those peculiar, lofty ambitions that he's expressed for the platform. Like, for instance, and I'll quote him directly here, he's always a treasure to quote directly. He wants to help humanity, whom I love. That's an interesting phrasing. Elon Musk loves humanity, and he wants to help it by buying Twitter. But quite what he's going to do is still clouded in uncertainty. I mean, he certainly put out the very extreme plan to fire 75% of the staff, and that plan seems still to be on the table. That, in spite of him saying when he visited Twitter's San Francisco HQ yesterday that the jobs were not in question. Well, it's hard to take him at his word when he's been so clear in the opposite direction. And then he was also photographed. Did you catch this, Marshall?
The sink.
Photographed. Exactly. Walking into the headquarters for the first time carrying a huge porcelain sink. What are we to make of that? I really don't know. Elon Musk is a puzzling character at the best of times, and this just about takes the sink, right?
Well, I looked at it and I said, I think this is his way of saying everything's going, including the kitchen sink.
Sure, except it happened to be a bathroom sink, but yeah. Let's not quibble about detail. But he also did say that he was trying to make sure that his message would sink in, but that seems a thin justification. The overall challenging question here, of course, is that he's described himself in taking Twitter over as a free speech absolutist. But the first thing he does, in actual practical terms, the first people he speaks to in his new role as the owner of Twitter, not the staff, he'll do that later today, apparently, not to Twitter's audience as a whole, but to the advertisers that, of course, he needs. I mean, Twitter is not in the healthiest state, as we know, and has not been for some time. Not growing the way that people would hope, people who invest in it, that is, in some trouble. Why else would he be able to finally get his hands on it? Why else would he be going for it? But it was that it was in a weak position and open to a takeover. At the same time, he spoke to the advertisers and saying to them that he's not going to make it. Make the Twitter experience into a free, what would he call it, a free speech, a free-for-all hellscape. I think lots of people do think that's exactly what he's had in mind. That's exactly what would suit him most of all, but it's so hard to tell with Musk. It's another of those stories where you have to say, in a terrible journalistic cliche, we will just have to see. More broadly, the week's digital media story has been falling incomes and consequently falling stock exchange valuations for the giants of the trade. Twitter is not that much of a giant, as we were just discussing. But Google's parent company, Alphabet, and Facebook's overall company, Meta, are really struggling in the markets, at least. It's a slump in advertising revenue that's the most obvious and immediate cause of the trouble, and it has been a rough week for them. And in part, I think that fall in advertising we can blame on the upstart Chinese-owned TikTok for that. But also, you know, it's unavoidable. It was an unavoidable consequence to what Apple, you know, on which is doing okay. I mean, not so great, but certainly not in as much trouble as Facebook and Google. But Apple has introduced new privacy measures on so many of their customers' devices that advertisers cannot any longer direct and place advertisements as precisely as they'd want to do. So the result of that is that there's a mass exodus of the traditional advertisers that Facebook and Google could rely upon. And in the case of Meta, that very change of name, I mean, from Facebook to Meta, is emblematic of things being worse for Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. His vision of turning Facebook into the metaverse, you know, virtual reality, and sinking an astronomical amount of money into the building of this new experience, the metaverse experience. His vision is that we won't all be living on Facebook, as he once saw as our fate, but all of us will be living in the metaverse. Very futuristic consideration. But Wall Street observers, even in the Wall Street Journal itself, have been calling this week's catastrophic, what is it? It's $700 billion of a collapse in valuation. They're describing it as a complete train wreck. As we all know, stocks can go up and they can go down. And maybe they'll recover from this soon. But for the moment, things are not looking so great in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, the ups and downs of the dot-com or dot-whatever you want to call it world. But, you know, you look at the ups and downs in the world, and you've now got an election in South America that is going on. You've got the British
Brazil,
government.
Yes.
Yeah, Brazil. You've got the British government, of course, changing prime ministers. You also have... something which I haven't heard our media talk about a lot, Northern Ireland. There, it looks like they're going to have an assembly election because a deadline was missed by Westminster for restoring the devolved government. I mean, these are all big news stories about elections going on, even in our country. Of course, what we started off talking about, the midterm elections. There's a lot going on in this world, counting on people to go out and vote.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it remains our most cherished possession in those societies that we describe as democratic. And there's a lot at stake in all of those particular places that you mentioned. And Northern Ireland, as you know, close to my heart, a very important part of my entire journalistic career. And I'll be back there, by the way, in a couple of weeks' time. I'll be able to give you a situation report from Ireland. It is remarkable, but not surprising, I have to say, that the British government, which is, you know, nominally still in charge of Northern Ireland, it's still part of the United Kingdom, but they're not paying much attention to it. It seems like the powers that be in London, certainly the Conservative powers who are in power, now, with a new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, replacing the unfortunate Liz Truss, they are not, frankly, paying much attention to Northern Ireland, and that will be to their own cost, as it as it pans out. There will be an important vote in Northern Ireland. It is possible that their self-governing assembly might be reconstituted. Let's hope so, because the unfortunate population of Northern Ireland, on both sides of the sectarian divide, have been, in effect, left without effective representation at governmental level for far too long now. And if it's possible to get a real Northern Ireland Assembly working again, that can only, well, I can say it can only be good. It may turn out to have its problems too, but it's a dire need that's been left unfilled for too long. And overarching all of the, as we look globally, overarching all the electoral considerations is the kind of event that swipes swipes the electoral process off the slate completely. War, of course, yeah. and the war that we must talk about is dominating the world more than any other. The one, a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is now creating more and more international anxiety with Russia's rhetoric about nuclear weapons. Denied sometimes, but then reinforced on another day, just like yesterday when Vladimir Putin said he was not going to use nuclear weapons, but at the same time, his underlying rhetoric was still in a threatening mode, like he and many of his closest advisors, so-called advisors, certainly been fast and loose with the idea of Russia using nuclear weapons, and even the new, or fairly new over the last week, propaganda gambit of claiming that so-called dirty bombs with nuclear material in them, conventional explosives but with nuclear radioactive material added to them. In this case, it's an accusation that the Russians are making that the Ukrainians would use such horrific weapons, allegedly as a false flag operation. Sounds fantastical, doesn't it?
It
could be. Well, I don't know. What's your take on it?
My take on it is exactly what you just said. It opens the door for this is what the media does. I hate to say this, but they on certain topics, they overanalyze. You take what Vladimir Putin says, and you take it at its face value, and you take it as what he has become. But I can't accept the American media with all this going on. And I actually sat yesterday afternoon for about an hour or two, and I switched between Fox, CNN, and CBS and MSNBC. And the major story they were covering was Kanye West. And you know what? I don't understand. I don't. You know, there are channels out there, entertainment channels, that can handle this. A well-known American star who has admittedly mental problems, and what he does and what he says. Yes, I guess it's a story, but it's not a story when you put it up with the war in Ukraine, when you put it up with the January 6th Commission, when you put it up with all that's going on in the world, the economic crisis, including the world's second leading economy, very close to the United States, China, and yet you get these out of an hour, 18 minutes to 20 minutes dealing with Kanye West. I just don't get it. Maybe I'm too old. Maybe I'm looking, but I just don't get it.
I don't think it's a question of age in the end. It's a question, really, as ever. I mean, the fundamental problem that faces all mass media in a journalistic sense is what in heaven's name to prioritize. We can't cover everything, so we've got to make some selections. And it's a dispiriting exercise. I applaud your dedication, sitting down and comparing live output from the news channels on TV for a couple of hours. But it is very instructive, isn't it? And to see that the Kanye, or just Ye for short, that phenomenon, I'm not going to talk about the man himself, but that phenomenon has come to be so important for the media, and that's the mass media, who measure their audiences in hundreds of millions, is a sad reflection on the kind of priorities that newsrooms sense to be the most important now. I would say that war is still the most important international event, and deserves all the emphasis that I would call the responsible media are emphasizing. So even here, you know, the angles on which newsrooms choose to settle as their biggest priority for the day can be very disturbing. The dirty bomb campaign, if you like, the propaganda initiative that it seems like it is. It looks suspiciously like, I'd say, a blustering sign of a military venture, Russia's military venture, that's gotten into a state of desperation, even while the Russians are pummeling the civilian infrastructure of the country, power and water supplies being displaced. But the propaganda dimension of this radioactive dirty bombs issue is essentially that it presents us with a really important media emphasis that is probably wrong-headed. But we need it to be looked at and considered in the round. And when you get developments in which the media itself is kind of implicated, it's all the more important for it to be disentangled. I mean, the IAEA, always important to get those initials right, the International Atomic Energy Commission, and its boss, Rafael Grossi, he was as the head of the agency, he was actually visiting the Washington Post this week when he took that media opportunity to say he'd go and personally make an inspection trip to Ukraine to, in his words, cool off the nuclear saber rattling that's been going on from the Russians. For many people, his action could be seen as in a way dignifying Russia's strange claims by taking them seriously. But you know, his organization is an important one, needs to be reported, and of course it does remain concerned with its own staff on the ground about the continuing barrage of missiles around the nuclear power plant Zaporizhia, where, you know, it's in Russian hands, but it's still being fought over. And explosives are going on around this nuclear power plant with all its stored nuclear rods and the like. This is all serious stuff, and it's a shame to see that Kanye West stands proud above all of that, at least when you turn on the TV, and that's shocking.
All right. Well, another interesting week to look at the media and the stories. And, of course, David has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. And we are so glad to have him join us every Friday. David, have a great weekend, and we'll see what comes up in the next week.
See you next Friday.
David Tarachuk with The Media Beat. Once again, his website, themediabeat.us. And you can find David here on Robin Hood Radio at robinhoodradio.com. Click on Demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Tarachuk.